You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and in this episode, I'm talking to Harriet Dyer, who is someone I've only recently, in the last couple of years, got to grips with her work. I've sort of gigged with her once or twice, but she's someone who's always been recommended to me as someone who'd be brilliant on this podcast, and those recommendations were absolutely right, so you could feel very smug if you made one of them. We are going to talk about Harriet's unexpectedly falling into stand-up during her uni years, encouraged by her lecturer, where she finally found her true calling, which paved the way for her show Trigger Warning. And it was watching that show, which is available free on YouTube, which really made me scramble to get her on the show. It's incredibly powerful. It's incredibly personal. And we will talk in detail about the complexities of navigating sensitive topics within the realm of comedy. Now, obviously, the show is called Trigger Warning. It is about some big, deep, horrible stuff that happened to Harriet over a long period of time. So I'm trigger warninging this whole episode as well. I never want people to miss out or switch off on things. She talks about some of the horrific things that have happened to her in such a light way, with such a light touch, which has all of this kind of emotion inside it. And it, I mean, she, listen, I'm tying myself in knots trying to explain this to you. What I'm saying is that we don't talk about some of these horrible things with the gravitas you might expect. And that is because she is entitled to decide how she talks about them herself. Is that fair? Basically, this is a big old trigger warning of an episode, but I don't want you to miss it because she is such a delightfully sort of daffy and absurd and wonderful, warm human being. So there you go. That's what I've got to say at the beginning. We're also going to talk about the addictive nature of comedy and its impact on personal happiness, and whether you can find contentment regardless of how your gigs are going. And we'll also talk a little bit about Harriet's advocacy for mental health and her role in running Barking Tales, which is a fabulous themed comedy night that she runs. So that's all of that. There's no extras from this. We had enough to play you some extras. But I decided I wanted to leave all of this one in because it sort of follows a pretty coherent narrative and I think it's all important stuff. I absolutely bloody love Harriet Dyer, and here she is. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Harriet. It's a joy to have you. I've just made a note in the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group with a link to Trigger Warning because I saw it. I texted you after I saw it. It blew me away. And I'm so excited to talk to you. And that's my starting point. I'm really excited to talk to you. We've gigged together. I've seen you compare, but I'd never seen you do like a set really, or certainly not a long set. And it just blew my head off. And I said, hey, I've got Harriet coming off the podcast. And loads of people got really excited about it.
Oh,
and I'm excited
nice.
About it too. So how is comedy treating you at the minute, Harriet?
Finally, I think comedy's treating me all right at the minute. We have, isn't it? It's very hickledy-pickledy. So one minute I'm like, oh my God, this is going amazing. And then the next minute I'm like, oh God, what am I doing with my life? So I have been feeling amazing about it all. And then, because if you're used to sort of constantly getting fun bits of work that you're looking forward to, and then if you go like a week or whatever, where you don't, I always then start doubting myself and and all that, really. So, well, I've never said that before, but yeah, because I think my whole life's happiness always depends on work, really. I'm miserable if work's not going well, and really happy when it is, which I need to... Well, I guess that's terrible, really, isn't it? I need to get... I don't have any hobbies or anything.
I feel exactly the same, and I know a lot of people who are comics will feel exactly the same, that we're really tied to the happiness afforded us by work. Like, that's part of the addiction, I guess, isn't it? Is that we kind of go, when I do this... Well, I mean, we were briefly talking about medication for various things before we hit record. It's a form of medication, right? You're like, oh, this... I need this thing. Do you feel like you're... Do you feel like that's inevitable? Do you feel like it is... Do you feel like you can learn one day to feel okay regardless of how gigs are going?
Oh, I don't know, actually, because even if I go, like, I can't relax. Like, if I ever, I rarely do, but if I ever I go on holiday, I'm just, I can never relax. And then I think about, and then does everyone do this when you're on holiday? You think you have these big epiphanies of what you're going to do different in your work and how things are going to change. It's only like I've only been for 3 days in Scunthorpe, and I've treated it like a bloody, like I've had a real awakening. I guess it always will be. Yeah, because you know when people go, oh, if you had all the money in the world or whatever, you'd give up your work and then you just do nothing or whatever. It's like, that sounds terrible. I definitely would. I'd always, even if I had all the money in the world, I'd still want to gig. So I guess it is inevitable that I will always feel like this, which is quite depressing, really, isn't it? That I'm always chasing that. So in the past, if I've done like drugs and stuff, I'll be chasing that. But then now I'm just always chasing this career high, I guess, which, but we all do that, don't we? And then I need to, we never step back enough and are grateful for at the minute. So I need to do that more often. Well, we all do, don't we?
Do you think about stuff like that a lot, or is it only when an idiot like me asks you about it? Because I relentlessly think stuff like that all the time. I can't help but constantly analyse every breath I take. And what does this mean? And what am I doing? And what's the plan? And that's why this podcast exists in many ways. Do you think about it? Because a lot of people don't. Do you kind of ever sort of end up kind of ruminating on it? And what's the quest? And where do I fit? And how's it going? Or, like, what kind of... Do you tend more towards that or more to, I'm just in the moment and I'm just chasing the moment?
No, I think I do. Because I think as well, if you've... Yeah, I try to appreciate, because I think I always... Well, I have to remind myself that I know I'm really lucky to do what I do and somehow make a living from it and all that. And then go to... Like, because I learnt to drive, like, quite late in life, and I'll be driving along to a gig and then there'll be the seaside or something, and I'll be like, oh, I am really lucky. So I do think that a lot and appreciate it. But then at the same time, if you've, like I said, if you get a few things and then you don't 1 week, then you do start to think, oh God, is this the end? So I did, because I guess with COVID and all of that, we were reminded more so that it could be the end, and that, I guess that's quite scary, because there's so many of us that if we're like sort of raggy dolls thrown on the heat on a pile, that, like, what do we do in the real world? I can't think of that too much, I guess.
It's that idea of what do we do in the real world. There is something about your style on stage, your approach, I think one of the really joyous things about watching you is how completely present you are with us. There's never any sense that you're doing the script. I think that's I think you'd agree with that. You're really right in there with us. And also one of the sort of things I thought a few times whilst watching various bits and bobs of yours is that it is quite hard to imagine you doing anything else. Do you know what I mean? I don't mean you wouldn't be capable of doing anything else, but you seem like you seem like, oh, isn't it wonderful for Harriet that comedy exists whereby she can completely be herself?
Well, yeah, well, my mum used to say that. Like, if ever I went home to visit her and I'd, I don't know, just be in the kitchen peeling potatoes or something, like, I wouldn't even know she was watching me, and then suddenly she'd go, oh, I just don't know how you exist in the real world. And she also used to say, I wasn't born, that I was created. And, which I don't really know, that's quite offensive, really. And I did always just, like everyone, I think, in comedy, sort of had a string of jobs that I never, like, I used to work in the Superdry shop in the ball ring, and even the managers there must have known that I was quite creative and needed to be, creative in order to function, and they were like, Harry, we've got a new job for you today. I was like, really? They were like, you're denim specialist. And I was like, that's not even a job, you're just making up these jobs to try and to connive me into thinking I'm being creative.
That is lovely, I suppose, in a kind of way. Do I interpret from that story that they were being nice by doing that? That they were trying to sort of, yeah, they were sort of cherishing your uniqueness and going, let's make you denim specialist. And then like, great, Harriet will love that. That's quite good management of you, I think.
Yeah. And it was nothing different. I just loitered by the jeans, I guess. But yes, I'm so grateful for comedy. And because I never, because a lot of comedians, they watched it as children and they had their heroes and all of that. Whereas I never really, like, I watched a few bits and bobs on telly that my parents sort of were watching. But I never ever thought of comedy as an option growing up. Definitely not. Yeah, so sort of just fell into it, I guess.
Can you tell us how you fell into it?
So I wanted to be an actor, and I was really lucky that my parents always knew that I would, because you get a lot of people's parents that want them to get like a proper job and that, and I was so lucky that my parents just always knew that I would do something strange, and like out of a film or something, we went to watch, we'd go on holiday to Plymouth as a family, and then we were watching a pantomime, and then they wanted volunteers at the pantomime, and they didn't pick me, but I ran on stage and was chatting, and then I had this Sylvanian family like weasel or something, and I was telling everyone that about it, and then I was like, oh, I'm gonna name it Joseph because my mom's having a baby that she's gonna call Joseph, and I wanted to call it Heady in case it didn't have a head, but mom said we couldn't do that. I just waffling on and on and on, and then after, like, out of a film, this guy, as I'm on the way back, goes to my mom, she's got real stage presence, like, and I was like only about five or something, so that was lovely. I can't remember what the question, what was, oh,
it was,
yeah,
how you discovered, or how you brought yourself to comedy.
Yeah, so always wanted to do acting, and then just had, well, quite a traumatic childhood, really, and then, but didn't have, I think people not from money, the only way to leave where you're from is to go to uni, but I didn't even want to go to uni, but it was just the only way because you get the money to go. So I had this lovely friend called Batty. She was going to Wolverhampton Uni, and I was like, well, I shall be going with you. And then it turned out to be the only uni in the country at the time that had a stand-up comedy module. And then so no one would work with me because I would go to lessons with gin in an Evian bottle, and then one day I've turned up and everyone's like, oh, are you ready for the stand-up comedy assessment? And I was like, the what? And then someone goes, oh, tell the story you told in the pub the other day about how you died twice, which is funny that it sounds. So then I did that, and then again, like out of a film, the head of drama was like, you're an absolute disaster, but you're really good at that, so I think we should help you. And then if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't, because she physically took me to the doctors to get extenuated circumstances because I was an alcoholic, and then if it wasn't for her, it would have just been like a waster that just dropped out of uni and that. So she, and it wasn't like, oh, and then I did comedy, it was still the absolute shit show, but then after that I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I was like, and you can, like, because it was such a good feeling that I went on, told everyone this story. Everyone was completely indifferent to me when I went on stage because they just thought I was this annoying person. And then I went on, was completely honest about my life. And then at the end of it, everyone's cheering and liking me and coming up to me and patting my back and that. And I was like, this is amazing. So then I had the, in my stomach, like I knew that's what I wanted to do then.
That's wonderful. not only is that a sort of brilliant and unique thing, what I love about that is to hear that, given the content of Trigger Warning, which is in part at least, is about how you were routinely let down by everyone, by the system, by the police, by just people around you, sort of exploited by terrible people around you and let down by systems which should have been there to protect you. And it's so wonderful to hear that, oh, some people were helping. Some people were making you denim specialist and going, you're a comedian, you've got stage presence, that there were some sort of positive forces giving you some options which otherwise you might not have been aware of.
Yeah, I never thought of it like that. Yeah, because if it was, yeah, so like, because I sort of say the other extreme a lot, but yeah, I'm actually very lucky because maybe other people have been through that where they've just had the badness, but I have been lucky. You know, thank goodness that even though my home life was difficult, it was outside of the home. Do you know what I mean? So like, my parents were always lovely and supportive, and yeah, it's just people must have seen something which is, yeah. And that poor drama lecturer, she was a doctor in stones, and so I don't even know why her specialist was rocks and stuff. She was fantastic, and but it got to the point she went absolutely above and beyond, because it got to the point where I was drunk all the time, that I was emailing her at like 4 a.m. because I'd just been out. And I think when you've been through abuse and stuff, you know if you sleep around because it hurts, and then when you do sleep around, that hurts even more because you're all triggered and that. So then I would debrief email her after stuff like that at 4 a.m. So she and the fact that she's still, you know, stuck with me, and she must have thought, fucking hell, what have I bloody bitten off here? But yeah, if it wasn't for her, just to think what would have happened. Very, very lucky, yeah, very lucky, people like that.
And do you feel like the connection you have with audiences and the opportunity that you have to, like you said, in that very first kind of gig environment, is just literally tell them a thing that happened to you. Do you, like, what's your sense of what it is that works so well when you get up on stage and just tell us the truth?
Well, because
why do you think we laugh so much? Why do you think we love you so much? What is that connection? What does it mean to you?
Well, someone said, well, a few people have said that they like, I bring people into my world. So I think that's, well, hopefully not the horrible stuff, but I think, because I've had it from both sides. So when I did that first thing, that was like a sort of presentation at uni, that was great. But then when I started comedy properly and did, you know, circuit gigs and that, I had just people, like, I guess I'm quite, I don't know if gullible is the right word, but quite trusting maybe, and after gigs, people would come up to me, always men, and they would tell me, right, well, you speak too Cornish on stage, so you need to be less Cornish, then you need to do this, then you need to do that. And then, so when I started on the circuit, I was changing every single fucking gig, because someone would tell me what I needed to do, and it was always people that were further along in their career. So I thought, well, they know what they're on about. So then every gig I was a completely different person. And then it was only then when I was always doing the King Gongs, and then Alex Boardman was like, you need to stop doing these bloody King Gongs, sorry. I didn't know what I was where, because you don't know until you know.
King Gongs, for people that don't know, it's a gong show environment where comedians are pitted against each other a deliberately hostile audience in an awful competitive facsimile of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, oh, it's awful. I saw one where someone was literally, a lady with a ferret puppet was it was terrible. But when she came on stage, someone punched her because they were so angry about it. Like it was, yeah, it was a really, and just the environment when you'd go in there, it wasn't like a normal, if you go to a normal comedy night, it is just such a hostile. What's a sport, isn't it? It's not comedy anymore.
It's gladiatorial, isn't it? And the crowd are baying for blood in a way that doesn't at all represent what comedy can and probably should be. And it's all, I've never done one. I've never participated in one. I think I've only ever seen one. But the whole idea, the stories I hear about them, it just makes me think it's almost like the prefect system in a boarding school, whereby the people who were abused, once they survive it, they abuse the new people coming up because now they're allowed. It's crazy. Deeply upsetting to me. But yes,
yeah, it is deeply upsetting. And then so Alex Baldwin was comparing it a few times when I'd done it, and then afterwards he was like, "Can you message me? Because please don't do these anymore." And I was like, "Okay." And then he was so lovely, and he sent a blanket email to all of his contacts saying, "Oh, there's this girl, she's really good. So will you give her a spot on a normal gig, please?" So then I got my first proper spot was at the bloody at the comedy store, the late show, doing a 10 spot when I had which is also quite stressful actually. So but then it was there, so what an opportunity. So Kevin Bridges was on, and then I went on stage, did terrible, and then he was like, "Why are you, when you're off stage, you're really funny, but then you're completely different on stage?" And then I realised, because I've been doing what everyone bloody told me to do, and I need to just do what I started and why I wanted to do it in the first place, and just talk about my life, because I've all my life I've had this terrible life where this is the first thing where I feel lucky to have lived a life. So it was then where I was like, well, now I will just talk about what happens, and then I just think, well, what happened, and then I just changed bits to make it funnier, and then that's what I do now, I guess.
I'm so glad for you. I'm so glad for you. Not only because I love your stuff, and having seen some of your stuff now, you're one of those people I'm like, oh, lifelong fan. I'll go and watch Harriet do literally anything. And I think you generate that response in people. I think you only have to look. I've got some audience questions for you we can get to later on. But a lot of it is just like, isn't she brilliant? You know, stuff like that. But there are questions among it. So to talk a little bit about trigger warning, which I'm very conscious of wanting to protect you and not take it anywhere you don't want it to go. And also the show is out there and it exists, and I want people to sort of see it and discover it. The things that struck me about that show, which I've only seen, wasn't lucky enough to see it in the room. I saw it, and I think the video that's on YouTube is at a particular event for survivors as abuse.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the context was exactly.
Yeah, it's the Viv Gordon Company, which do, so they came to see my show in Edinburgh, and then we've sort of become really close, and it was doing it to do that show in front of all survivors, and that it was in Bristol as well, which is, so it was just lovely, really really nice. And when do you ever get to do that, where everyone, because a lot of the time, especially in Edinburgh and that, there was just people that haven't, because even though the show was called Trigger Warning, you still always get people deeply upset, and it was always the same sort of people that probably haven't had, I can't say for sure, but probably haven't had these experiences, like to get upset on behalf of, well, I don't know who the fuck. So it was lovely to do it just for people that get it, really. And then, so I'm really happy that one got filmed.
Can you, just so we're not sort of, I feel like for the listener, we need to kind of sketch out the content, but only to the extent that you're happy. So what's your kind of description of the show in such a way that we know what we're talking about and it's your words and not mine?
So the show was, I never thought I'd talk about it. So it's a show about how doing a paper round led to a lifetime of rape. Is that what it is? and then it really helped. And then when I left Cornwall, then things got better, and then it happened again, and then it was terrible, but now it's fine. Is that fair?
Yes, that, I mean, of course, don't ask me if that's fine. I just want, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just aware that there is, you know, and I've sort of said this comes up on this sort of show from time to time, because I'm interested in psychology and coping with things. Whenever I talk to someone who has really been through some of the horrific experiences that you have, I'm just very mindful that, like, that you have a sort of abandoned subject button whenever you want.
You know what I mean? And I don't want to, because I've done a podcast before where they have to do a list of trigger warnings before that, then after I've spoken, the list of trigger warnings is longer than the fucking
well, this that has come up on one or two episodes before, whereby you do, like, I mean, one of the questions, as you'll know, Johnny Pelham sort of survivor of child sexual abuse, and I was asking him about how it feels to know that whenever he talks about that, he always comes with it's like a comma after his name. Do you know what I mean? And obviously, as comics, we are wrapped up in our identity is to do with our output, and you know, it becomes a sort of part of a thing around you that I suppose from the outside, I want to make sure it's a thing that you're owning, rather than even the acknowledgement, even the warning about it, isn't a thing that then becomes out of your hands.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, and as you talk in the show, the decision to call it trigger warning was to sort of cover yourself in an extent so that you could go, look, I did tell you, you know. So one of the, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the journey of developing that show. Because one of the things, and obviously the only version of it I've seen is that one in front of an audience of survivors. The frankness with which you talk about some of the horrendous things you experienced is, and because of your natural style as a comic, you'll sort of say something very bleak and unpleasant that happened to you, and literally half a breath later you'll get distracted by a tangent about squirrels that's very funny. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a real barrage of stuff. It speaks beautifully to you and who you are. And like I said, that thing about how present you are, we feel like this is Harriet's turn to speak and she can say it however the fuck she wants. I wondered if you could just talk to me a bit about the journey of putting that show together, and were there times when it was hard to change gear, or were there times when you would perform it to audiences that didn't take it in the way you wanted them to, and the difficulties associated in that, how you overcame them, those kind of things?
I never thought about talking about it really, and then during lockdown I was one of these millions of people that decided, I thought I'd write a book, but just to get all my because I love reading about people's processes and how they've overcome stuff. So I read a lot of autobiographies and stuff, and then I because I read so many of them, and I was like, oh, I think mine would probably be as good. So then I just wrote a book during lockdown, and then but then in having done that, I already, and doing comedy as I was writing it, I had already put in funny bits around those bits. So then I decided to, I think it was like a 2000 and, oh no, I feel like, oh no. So then after that, I thought, oh, well, I'll see if there's, because I don't know if I felt, comically, if I felt that I'd feel like that, like it was all very well and good doing all this material, but there's always this big thing that I've never really spoken about. And do you know what I mean? So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And then So then, at a work in progress, I just thought, well, okay. Oh, yes. So then I did it, and at that gig. So I knew this woman. I'd been doing previews at this venue for years and years, and I always thought we got on well. And then did this show about the trauma that I've been through in the paper round and stuff. And then afterwards, she was just completely different with me. And then I thought I was being paranoid, but then I knew people that had come to the show, and they told me that they got home that night to an email from her apologising on my behalf. And then the next day she was just emailing me, going on about trigger warnings and all of that. And then she said that I need to check, because I've got this bit about stabbing the abuser. And then she's like, you need to make it really clear to the audience what bits you've made up, like that bit. And I was just so outraged, because I've just had a lifetime of people not believing me, and then I haven't spoken about this like ever, and then I have, and it's the same fucking shit after all these years. So I was just so angry with her. Because what else was she saying as well? Was it just and again, because I even said to her, sorry, who are you upset? Because she was also like, oh, I think people are going to need a while to get over what you told them. And I was like, who are you doing this on behalf of? Has someone said something? And no one had said anything. So she was just upset on, oh, I don't know what she was doing. And I don't, well, you know, I'll never know fully what she has been through or if she knew anyone that had been through stuff or whether it triggered something for her. But it really did trigger something for me. So then that's why, so then I was just really angry that that's still happening and people that have been through stuff are still, you know, being shamed essentially for it. So that's why I did it. And then I just wanted to make it, I wanted to make sure that even though it was terrible stuff, if I could still make it funny. But yeah, it was true. Like, I don't, every so often now I get asked to do it at stuff and I won't do it anymore because I obviously did it every day in Edinburgh and it was a lot to do every day for a month. And I'm like really proud that I did it and that I made that funny and that, but I never want to do it again.
and does that mean the book is done? Or, like, does it mean in the sense of you've concluded working on the book and you feel like the work is done so you don't need the book? Or is the book still a thing?
Oh, the book I put it out there on Amazon during lockdown. Yeah.
This is a big gap in my research.
So that's out there and then this is out there. But then I feel like I've unleashed a beast because now every single thing that I write is always a bit depressing now. It never really was before. But I guess just life is, you know, life is, I guess, a bit. So
when you say you've unleashed a beast, do you mean in terms of your freedom to talk about how you really feel?
Like, yes.
I don't know if that is unleashing a beast. I think you deserve the permission to talk about how you really fucking feel.
Well, yeah, but I just don't want to be known as one of the, I just don't want people to think, oh God, I'm not going to go see Harriet anymore because it's just very depressing because then there's a show about me bloody dead mother and now I've got a show about bloody everyone killing themselves and but it's just stuff that happens, I think, and I find it really difficult to write about stuff that I don't care about and that I don't feel. I find it really hard, like if I ever have tried to do like observational stuff or I don't care. I feel like I really need to care to be able to commit to a show that I'm going to do work. It's going to be, you know, like an hour long and I'm going to do it at lots of places. I feel like I need to care about it.
Do you think that was there anything in the reaction to Trigger Warning at Edinburgh, like the reaction from the audience, which made you think it was depressing? Because to me, that is the last word I would use to describe that show. Parts of it are harrowing because they're awful things to have happened to someone and we care about you deeply. But I was emotionally very engaged. I wasn't depressed because it was uplifting. Jesus, the last line of that show, just before, and I don't want to spoil it for people watching it. It's not even really a punchline. It is a detail of what your partner says to you when you tell him you've got a problem, and you said that, and then there's another line, and then you go, and that's the show. And I literally, if I say it out loud now, I'll burst into tears. But then it hit me so hard, and it's not depressing; it's joyful and uplifting, and it's fucking brilliant, mate. It's brilliant. Aww. That show and where that show goes. And I completely understand you may never want to do it again. But I also feel like I have a responsibility as the part of me which is a comedy fan, let alone a fellow comedian, to say, don't worry, this isn't depressing. Don't have that in your head. You're not depressing. And what we're getting is you being you and you're joyful and uplifting no matter what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Well, that's lovely. I feel like I don't think I was fishing there because that was just. I know I had no idea. Yeah, I think. Well,
Also, I certainly don't want to be the latest in a long line of men telling you what you should or shouldn't do.
yeah, but no, that's lovely, because I think I did think it was quite depressing just because of... And do you know what as well? Because I think when I did it in Edinburgh, there was the... It was the... as is often the way... Because it's obviously in the summer, and I was in a room where the aircon was... There was something wrong with the aircon, and it was pumping spores because it was mouldy inside. So it was like this... Yeah, well, it was awful. And so the room was so hot that people were having to leave because they were passing out and stuff. So then I think I took that on. Do you know what I mean? So then even when people were like, no, it's not the heat, I think I took, like, you know, people had to leave where, and I never truly know if they were leaving because they were filled with spores or, you know, or... So I think maybe I took, and we all do it, don't we? We focus on... And I think as well, because when you've just lived something, like, it's not really shocking for me because I was bloody there. So maybe I took people's shock and maybe just being in the moment and processing and stuff. I think sometimes I sort of maybe took that on as it was a bit depressing, but people are just, yeah, because it's hard to know when you know it, you know? You know?
Yeah, no, totally. I completely understand. One of the things, let's come away from that subject and talk more about the kind of your wider relationship to your audience, who you are to them. Who do you, in your mind, who are you to your audience?
Oh, who am I to my audience? I haven't really thought about it before, but people often say to me if they've like watch shows or see me online and stuff, they go, oh, you are like what, the inside of my head, like the stream of consciousness that I just never say out loud. So I think I'm high on stage and people's mania coming to life in front of them before their very eyes. But I'm very comfortable in who I am, and but then I have, you know, people, some people would say I'm a real oversharer and stuff, but I guess I just feel comfortable with who I am, and there's rarely, like, I'm rarely thinking anything that I'm not saying out loud, which I guess is a gift or a curse, because sometimes I will be like, oh, I'm quite itchy, you know, people are like, what?
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. I'm rarely thinking anything that I'm not saying out loud.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful sentence. I'm really interested in that because, like, we see those things, you know, that you might think, oh, I'm itchy, or what? Well, there's a moment in one of your shows where you said, I think it was in the video I saw, Trigger Warning, where, like, halfway through there's just this little moment where you sort of go, you're describing a door. And you sort of go, because it's a door. Yeah, it's a door. It's so funny because we're seeing you live in real time. Remember what a door is called, or sort of discover that there's nothing more to be said about the door. And what I'm interested in is how many of those moments which become, because you're so sort of loose and present and silly on stage, we laugh at all those moments. Do you ever repeat those moments because you've discovered that they're funny and you've found a funny way to describe a door? Like, there is presumably a sort of a whole spectrum of things which you're genuinely saying because your arm's itchy or you've got pen on your leg or whatever, and you point it out and see if it... And presumably when you point it out, you are aware that you have the option to pursue it and see if it goes anywhere.
Yeah.
And then right on the other end, there's script, which you say every time. So what's the kind of interplay between those things?
Yeah, well, you can't, isn't it? I always used to try and reenact stuff, and if I've got stuff wrong, but then do it. But I think audiences can smell it when they. I think I'm just a bit like, I feel dirty for trying to trick them, you know. So I might say, oh well, the other day when I did this bit and then this, so I might say that something's happened, but I try not to. Although Although sometimes, like, for instance, sometimes if I'm, like, if I'm a bit nervous and then I'm on stage and I'll just, like, touch myself, then I'm like, bloody hell, Harry, don't touch yourself. And I'd say that a lot, but that's just because, like, I do it out of nervousness, I think. So, but then I don't know.
So you never kind of plan to say that so much as you notice yourself touching yourself out of nervousness.
Yeah.
But you know you can, you know that to remark on it will be funny.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it. Okay.
But I find it different, like, I've often in, like, feedback and reviews and stuff, like, with various things, people have said, oh, her tangents and stuff are often funnier than her material, so she should focus on them. But how can you focus on the tangents and how, do you know what I mean? Sometimes I find it difficult to, because I can't just assume that something funny will come. You can't live your life like that. So then I do have where often I'm always funniest, like, off the cuff rather than the things that I spend hours and years working on. But I think that's the same for a lot of people, maybe, but that's sometimes a bit disheartening. But then that's the good thing, even though it's a good and a bad thing, everyone films everything these days. That's a good thing, I guess, to watch back and have no idea that I've said something funny and then go, oh, well, there could be a bit in that or whatever, but not to pretend like it's new.
Sure. Yes. And what's the beginning of the writing process look like? You're writing Mother at the moment. Is that right? It was work in progress.
Well, that was another thing. Because I was gonna do work in progress. I just get so bored of doing the same thing. So in the end, I just did it for a week, and then I probably won't do it. And then I'll probably get it recorded and whack it on YouTube, and then I'm just bored of it really now. So now I've got another one called Skin that I'm doing this year. But I need to. But how do people? Because you've got ADHD, how do you, and I haven't been diagnosed with it, but I find it very difficult to, how do you keep the love when you're having to do days and days and months of the same thing?
I really struggle with that. And I think when I got my ADHD diagnosis, I had a lovely month afterwards of kind of reflecting on all of my past behaviours and what have you. Suddenly all of the relentless self-analysis and self-reflection had a thing to kind of accrete around. And one of the things was recognising how much happier I am when I'm being off the cuff. And I love doing work in progress. I love doing work in progress.
I do.
I enjoy doing finished shows, but I cling to it. I'm scared. I want to do finished stuff that will work, but it's the bet. You know, when I tour, I do the hour show. That's the finished show. Then a break, and then new material off notes. And the second half is always better because I'm more present and I'm in the moment. And I think what I put it down to now post diagnosis is, to some extent, it's not that I'm bored doing the show. I'm just really excited in the novelty of doing the new stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the things that maybe has held me back in the past as a circuit comic is my sort of need to wedge in new stuff between two good bits that isn't necessarily ready, rather than focus on, I'm the headliner, it's half an hour, every word I say is going to be honed and I'm going to keep honing it. Like, so that you see people, I remember, like, early Rod Gilbert when he was doing his five and then very slowly chunking on another perfect two and then chunking on another perfect three, and now it's a perfect 10-minute set. I'm in awe of that. I love it. I see the benefits. I know that I would get bored doing that were I even... I was like, no, I'm too bored to make a perfect 10. Do you know what I mean? my point is that is one of the things I would struggle with were I to attempt that. And it's also why I don't attempt that. You know, I get all het up doing a perfect... Like, this is my best shot for a telly spot. I get super nervous about it because that's it. Because as soon as it's there, I'm like, great, I never have to do it again.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, the short answer is I really struggle, and I think this podcast is about you, but you asked the question, so yeah. My internal narrative on it has been that in the beginning, I think I was struggling to be a perfectly written type comic, but really deep down, I was sort of more excited about being a Ross Noble, Phil Kay type comic, where you just leap from place to place, but then that would kind of come up against my desire to be
trusted and to make money. Do you know what I mean? And to like be reliable.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So this is Harriet. It's a ride this episode, I know. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for sticking with it. I am just in awe of Harriet. I'm in awe of her. I say robust all the time, but the kind of the robust core of what she gives to the world, despite how ghastly the world has been to her. And you must see this show. You must see Trigger Warning. I'll put the link in the show notes. It is an incredible piece of work. And it is also, it's like there's some darkness in there, of course, but the lightness with which she manages to talk about it. And it is so daffy and silly and funny. And then wallop. It's brilliant. If you see one show this year, make it this one. So more from Harriet in a second. There's no insiders content on this one, as I mentioned. But you can, of course, go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders. If you're thinking this Christmas time, golly, it's about time I signed up to give something back to the podcast, then please do that. You get extra content from every show that has it. And much more, including a special video version of this episode. But I don't know why I'm telling you that now, because you would need to be in the Insiders to get it. We are converting the Insiders Club, and there's going to be more and more video content of episodes there. But we will be, it's Zoom video, some of it's in-person video, the stuff that's coming up. We've got episodes, oh my God, we've got episodes coming up with Josh Pugh, with James Acaster returning. We have, who else have we got? Leo Reich, absolutely brilliant. And who else? Someone else magnificent as well. Mohan Rizwan is coming on too. So I've got all of these incredible episodes burning a hole in my hard drive, and they have full or partial video, which you can access via the Insiders Club. So feel free to do that for all the Insider Q&As and the Self-Help for Comedians special with Amanda Connell. So all of that is all good. You can go to harrietdyer.com or follow Harriet on Instagram at harrietdyercomedy. And let's get back to this interview. One of the thoughts I had in 2019 after I did a work in progress all month, and it was my favourite Edinburgh at the time. I just loved it. I thought, what does finished mean? One of the wonderful things about this fucking job is that you can do precisely what you want. So why do we all take what we want to do and submerge it beneath this idea of, oh, no, but I have to do this? No, you don't. What you have to do is precisely what the fuck you want. So maybe we should do an ADHD festival,
nothing's finished ever.
Just the unfinished, the unfinished festival. I'm going to get that.com right now. Because I would much rather see that. You know, watching people's finished stuff I find less interesting than watching them grapple with a thing in real time.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's a, I was chatting to a friend about this recently that I need to not do, but it's very tempting. Like if you do a show and it's, you know, about this and that, and then it's at the end, and it was then I realised that, like, I don't want to do any of that. And I think I kind of did it with the last show, and then I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that. I just want people people could just fucking decide what it was about. Neat it up at the end.
Totally, I think, and that's when I realised. For me, the other version of that is, and in that moment.
Yeah.
Like, to me, like, I feel like I might mean that, but I'll catch myself saying it and I'll go, what am I doing here? I'm trying to tie things together in a way that maybe they don't. Or, you know what I mean? Like, to sort of artificially... I mean, the other example from years ago when I started in comedy, everyone was going, and then that guy said the funniest thing I've ever heard. And then you deliver some lukewarm thing a person said. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's those kind of tricks, those traps.
Yeah.
Are there, on that subject, are there particular habits or holes that you routinely fall into? Are there things that you spot, both positive and negative? Are there things where you're like, well, when I get to that shape of a thing, I'm sure something will come. And are there bits where you're like, oh, God, I'm doing that again?
When I watch stuff back, I think so many comics do it and I'm guilty of it. When you deliver a punchline and then there's that moment where you're waiting for laughter, so then you go, and then you start the next thing, but you know a laugh should go there and no one really knows what to do. So you make a noise that's really cringy that everybody does.
What's your noise?
It's like punctuation, isn't it? And so many people do it, and I don't know what the answer is, because I'm a lot less scared of silence than I used to be, but I think that there is a need, isn't there, to always be right, what's next? And whereas I think to just be able to pause and let people laugh and then...
Totally, you're conducting a band, and if you go and now laugh and they don't, you're like, well, what the fuck happens now?
Yeah, exactly.
Are there kind of creative ones or like writing ones? Do you find yourself like that kind of in that moment? Do you have things where you spot yourself?
Oh, like, yeah.
Everything... Oh, this joke is sort of a version of that joke. Does that ever
come up? Yeah, I'm really bad for regurgitating stuff. It's good if it's like an idea that I once had that never went anywhere. Then it's like, oh, if I then can get that to work, it's like really good. But then I'm like, Harriet, that's a bit that you were schlepping out that you're trying to bloody rejig. And then also, for some reason, my natural, if I'm trying to write sort of circuit stuff and stuff that's less delving into life things, every single... punchline, my brain goes, what about a little whimsy animal bit? And I'm like, Harriet, no more whimsy animal bits. We get the picture.
Yes, I wonder how you deepen or enrich the instinct to put a whimsy animal bit in it. But like, what kind of, could it be a supernatural creature or a deep sea creature? Could it be like, could it go further and deeper? Yeah. Like, because the instinct is probably absolutely right. But if you're like, God, it's another squirrel.
And then I think, because even though it's slightly surreal, I think to get to the stage where, because you know, often if say, so, I don't know, like a one liner or something, you can see, or with anyone, you can see their format. And then you often when watching their set or a show, you know what's coming. So I think I have to be careful that even though it's a surreal thing to have as a punchline, that if even those, the audience are predicting, because they're like, yeah, she's getting a squirrel out here, because it's always a bloody squirrel with her.
Is there anyone else that you're a bit like or are playing the same notes as, that if they're on a bill, you think, oh, this might be too much of this flavour?
So do you know what, because you don't often get Cornish comedians, so it's not that they're so I've been on a bill with Matt Price before, and we're in no way similar, even though his dad lives the opposite side of the river to my dad. They're literally and his dad's gay, my dad's gay, like it's really weird that we have, and he used to work at a fish factory, and I remember when I was leaving school the fish factory was on fire and everything smelled like fish, so a lot of our lives are quite similar, things that have happened. But so when I've gigged with him, I think the last I gigged with him was in London, and he was comparing, and when I went on stage everyone was just like confused I don't even know what they were confused about, that someone else that was Cornish existed, or maybe there was just similarities, and maybe probably how we spoke, because we really are from, you know, the same area and that. And I don't know, maybe he mentioned his dad and I mentioned, but people just weren't buying it for some reason. And then recently I did Late and Live and Tamsin Kelly was on before me. And I thought, oh, is the same thing going to happen here? But yeah, there was no. So it was weird that, yeah, with Matt, but not with Tamsin.
I wonder, might it be because you adopt, and I've not seen Matt for ages, a brilliant comic. Do you adopt a similar sort of position of your Cornishness in opposition to the room that you're currently in?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I still don't know what the answer was, but it was odd. But maybe it was just, yeah, well, yeah, I don't know. But then I have once, I got, when I was new, I got introduced by the Corpo who promotes that, which runs the gigs as well. And he said, this next act's going to tell you that she's Cornish, but she's lying to you. And then everyone was just like, never on board, because they were like, well, you're telling us who you are, but we know you're lying. And I was like,
oh my,
I am not.
God.
But then as well, it's not, like I hadn't been going long enough to get into it and unpack it and say how ridiculous it all was, because I was still, this is what I will say. I was just really confused.
What things do you roll your eyes at in comedy or think, oh, look, this is getting better, but we need more of this, or anything like that?
I don't know really, because when I was a lot newer, I remember doing those, like the jonglers and the frog and that. I remember being introduced, and when the audience, because obviously I got a female name, they'd hear that a female was coming, and the whole 200 or whatever, you'd hear an audible groan, and that was just harrowing to go on stage knowing that you're already, they just think, and then following once at jonglers, I was doing like the trial 10 and there'd been a female act before me, and then as I got on stage, not another fucking woman. And it's just like, yeah, that was awful. And it's so, it would be, because often you're the token lady on the bill, so it would be lovely to, because whenever there's a few of us on the bill, it's so exciting and we all get on so well and have such a lovely time. But yeah, so I guess there needs to be more. But some people are really, really good for it. And, you know, there's the whole lineup's all female and it's never even mentioned. And then some people, it's just very... do you know what? That's one thing. They have the bill, and always, no matter who it is, the woman will always be put on in the middle. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, she needs a little... The audience needs a little break between the lady. Best not put her on first. And that's... And then you look at, you know, what the bill is, and it doesn't make sense for it to be like that. If it does make sense, then that's fine, but not if it doesn't. Just the lady. Sure. Some people have, the lady is always in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about your advocacy for mental health. You're a mental health advocate, according to your website.
Well, I didn't know I was until everyone started telling me I was and introducing me and telling me. So then I was like, well, that sounds good. So that's what I am then.
But you are, because you run a... What's the night you run? Or it's like a...
Barking Tales. So I went to the... Yeah, so years and years ago, when I did my first solo show, it was about mental health. And then and everyone was just like, wow, it's great to talk about it this openly. So then I was like, oh, well, I'll...
Oh, you started it. You start it.
But I was like, but then afterwards I wasn't ready for the conversation about it, because it was just so good. Everyone coming up to me wanted to talk about it and being so open and honest, and people saying, oh yeah, my sister, she's got these problems, and then now watching your show, it's opened up conversation and all that. So I was like, oh, and it was at the time, I think it was 2014, when it was in the media how comedians are all off their tits, it was said, isn't it? They struggle a lot. So I thought, oh, well, there'll always be people willing to do it. So then I just started this little night in Manchester. And the interesting thing was that it quickly became, I thought it would be about the comedians talking about mental health stuff, that they wouldn't feel safe, like it was a safe space in other places. But it ended up being mainly about the audience, and it was people that, you know, wouldn't feel comfortable going to a club night and, you know, people get... Often people have... sensitive to noise, I have noise defending headphones, and there's, you know, and then we'll just sit in the audience, and you know, people that have got tics and would feel like the comedians are going to pick on them for it and stuff like that. So it became like a little community, I guess. But then because I'm not very technically minded, when I was doing it in these venues, the speakers were blowing and everyone was triggered and having a terrible time. So yeah, it was awful because I was such a calamity. Everyone was like rocking and twitching because of the fucking my awfulness getting all this discombobulated. So then I got, when lockdown happened, because my partner's kids came to live with us in a tiny space, so I got an office to go and do work at. And then it was big enough to, I was like, oh, well, I'll do my Barking Tales at this little space, and just have it. We have like Fisher Price microphones and no sound system, and just do like a spoken word sort of thing, really. So do it there now.
Something I've noticed on stage is if I ever mention having ADHD, I used to have a bit about it. I've dropped it all because it's so familiar now. You've been in clubs and like everyone's mentioned it. But I've got a little one-liner about it. And often if I lose my place, because I have a big problem with memory, if I lose my place, I'll mention ADHD. I'll do my little one-liner. And then as soon as I've mentioned it, I behave differently for the rest of the gig. I'm more likely to lose my place because on some level I don't use this term really, but it's almost like if I've stopped masking it, it becomes more pronounced. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
I've given myself permission, or I've said it now, and on some level that I haven't really articulated to myself, I sort of feel like I'm being a bit all over the place and sort of, I can't help it. Do you, with your, you are bipolar? You have bipolar? I don't know the language.
Yeah. But I don't know, because I don't know if I've... Because everyone's like, Harry, you definitely have ADHD, so I don't know whether I take things and I... Because when I was officially diagnosed with bipolar, and then before that, I was a lot different, and there was a lot of sort of... I was off on rampages and stuff, whereas now I do consider... But then it might just be because I've... you know, because I'm taking the drugs and that, maybe. So I don't know, but I don't fit. Yeah, I don't feel. And then when I, you know, see other people that are now, like a friend recently has been diagnosed with it, and I think, oh, maybe I don't know if I do have it anymore, but probably. But then I need to watch out for this, because this is what happens every so often. I'll think, well, I don't need to take this medication anymore. And then I just stop it. This happened once years ago, and I tried to throw myself out of a moving vehicle with my partner, and he was like grabbing hold of me on the M67. So I need to just get over myself and just keep taking the drugs.
Do you feel like... One of the questions my prescriber asked me when I was sort of saying, oh, I'm going to go on this, and she knew what I did for a living, and she said, are you concerned about the effect on your creativity? And at the time, I was like, no. Do you mean? I'm like, give me the stuff. I'll see. If it doesn't work, I'll stop taking it.
Yeah.
Do you find that your medication has had an effect on your creativity? Because I know that's something that people are concerned about. I know we're talking about very different types of medication.
Yeah.
But... in terms of, we started, before we hit record, we were sort of beginning to have a conversation about like your reaction to meds and how they interact with your stage time, how they interact with your creativity off stage, maybe writing and what have you. What's your experience of that?
At first, I just, when I first started taking it, I felt really stoned, and then, but I just stuck with it, and then I felt fine. And then when I upped the dosage, I felt again a bit stoned again. But now, but I don't think it affects anything. And then when I first started taking it, people were like, oh, Harry, you seem a bit more relaxed on stage. So I was like, oh, maybe that's because of the drugs. But then back in the day, I'd be on them, and then I'd sometimes be drinking as well. And then that just got into a bad habit of doing. But now, yeah, I think because it's been so long now, I don't know, and it all seems to be fine, so I assume it's fine.
Am I right to assume that you're in a place now where you're on an even keel.
Yeah.
You're not addicted to anything.
This
you're
is
medicated.
As even as I'll, yeah. as I'll get. Yeah.
And how does that feel like you can go on forever like this?
Yeah, I think so. I think, because when I have tried to come off it, I've just done it stupidly. And then even, because when was it? Maybe a year or so ago. No, a couple of years, I don't know. My partner was like, can you please go back on your medication? Because you are just very terrible. I said, okay. And then, you know, now I live in the countryside and I'm very medicated and I'm very zen and happy and doing what I love. So I find all that helps as well, doesn't it? Because I could be very medicated and very sad.
Yeah, yeah. How do you cope with tough gigs when things go wrong? How do you cope? What's your kind of thought process? What are the things you say to yourself?
Well, now I think, isn't it, when you've been doing it a while, you know that it's an anomaly. Back in the day, it used to be, oh God, what am I doing? But now I know that it's more likely, like, either I'm off or they're off, or it might not be down to me, where I used to always put it on me and what I was doing. And I think, oh, well, maybe that bit's not working. And so I need to work on different bit. I find it quite inspiring, because I always want to keep writing and I don't want to get into the habit where I'm just one of these people that slogs the same set out for 20 years and nothing's changed and there's references to Jamster and, you know, so I just think, oh, well, maybe that bit isn't working. And yeah, so I think we're all a bit guilty sometimes of going, because it cringes me out when people go, they blame everyone other than themselves and they say it's the audience, but everyone else has had a good gig. So it's like, well, maybe you're not doing something quite right. So I think, you know, I want to be the best I can. So if it is difficult, I want to, unless it's, I don't know, like, you know, people are doing coke off each other's heads and stuff, and then I know that that is the issue and there's nothing I could have done.
Are you kind of building your own crowd? Are you doing... I must confess, I haven't looked at your social media. I don't know how active you are on kind of putting stuff out and building an audience and those things. But, like, what do you want from comedy? And do you think in those terms, like, 5-year, 10-year plan, loose assumptions about what to do next?
Yeah, I guess I just keep doing what I'm doing. I guess I could... Yeah, I don't think I've got the biggest, definitely not the biggest social media presence. And I find all that very, like, I know it needs to be done, but it's all very vacuous. So I guess I try my best. But because four main platforms to do, and then we do everything, a different thing for each one every single day. I don't know how there's time for that. So I guess just keep building and then to eventually be able to just tour, I guess. And because I don't think I'm ideally the right act for really drunk people on a Saturday night where I've got to somehow relate to them to make them laugh when they're off their tits. I haven't been for quite some time, so I don't know if I care for them very much. So I'd like to get to the stage where I, you know, where I can solely just write stuff, create stuff, and people come to it, and then I don't do. But I guess I'm a bit more, because I would do everything, but, you know, I used to do just always gig, and now I guess I'm a bit more selective. And that's nice, isn't it? To go, oh, I've got an arts centre coming up. How lovely.
Yes. It is weird, those things where, like, I feel like you and me both have done the hard yards, thanks. And I don't think I'm going to be improved anymore by doing horrible tough rooms that I don't enjoy, where I try to relate to people I don't relate to.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely not, you know, no, I don't think I'm better than them or anything, but it's just I don't have what they want.
I had some audience questions for you. Did you move from Cornwall to do comedy, or was that a separate thing? And now you're, dare I say, a big name on the scene. Does part of you feel like moving back?
No, I left Cornwall for trauma because I just needed to get out of Cornwall. I think it's just... You can't really commute anywhere, can you? You'd have to, but it's so great. There's so many people. In fact, I last saw Kev, the time before I saw Kev, at a gig, Tom Rogers, I think he's called. And he's fantastic. And there's so a few people in now in Cornwall that are putting on fantastic nights. And so there's more of a circuit now. Because there used to be Graham and he used to do loads. And now there's some other people. And so there's a little circuit there now, which is great. I don't know, because I would be the same if I was in my caravan on the beach. I wouldn't want to be going anywhere else. So you need to start. There needs to be a caravan circuit. That's the answer.
Good idea. That's a very good idea. To wrap up, thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed this. It's been lovely talking to you. I have started asking people, and if this goes nowhere, we'll cut it. But on this podcast many years ago, Sarah Millican shared with us Millican's Law, which was about a sort of, not overdoing it past 11 o'clock the next morning, regardless of either way the gig had gone. What would be your law if you had Dyer's Law in comedy, that's a thing you've learned or a technique that you employ that you think everyone would benefit from this? What would be your law?
I guess lots of people have said this, but don't think about everybody else. Be yourself, and don't, you know, if you've liked a comedian, because I think every so often you get like where people are just versions of who they've been watching, where it's a really saturated scene, isn't it, really? So I guess be yourself and don't be afraid to be yourself, and don't listen to anyone else's shit when they're telling you to be this and be that. Just stick to what you want to do, I guess, because I don't know whether that went anywhere, but
I liked it. It's good. It's very emblematic of you. I just wonder, are they like, I wonder if it's like, it's easy to say just be yourself, and I'm just interested in like, how do people, like, if someone's listening to this thinking, that's all very well, Harriet, but how do I be myself? Because I get on stage and I just find myself doing this version.
Yeah, but like, going, because so many people, when they start, they're like, they'll watch comedy and then they'll go, ugh, where'd it go? So I said, stop shouting at me, Mum. You know, and it's always like don't just go for the easy stock things that you see everyone else doing, because then there's literally a whole lineup of just everyone doing the same variation.
Last question. Are you happy?
Oh, very happy. Yes. Yes, thank you.
I'm so pleased. I thought I wouldn't have asked if I didn't think you were, but I asked that of lots and lots of people, and I was pretty confident of a good answer. And yes, I am. Thank you is a beautiful place to end it, and very, very typical of you and your energy. And I'm just in love with your act, mate. And thank you so much for doing the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks ever so much. Do I just go now?
And let's cut there. So that was Harriet. Oh, mate. She's so wonderful. I'm just completely in love with her comedy. I think she's an absolutely wonderful human being. And I really am so anxious for you to discover her if you haven't already. And it's just such a wonderful, she has such a wonderful style. That's enough gushing from me. Thanks to Harriet for coming on the show. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to support the show with a regular monthly donation of as much or as little as you like. And get all the extras, including the video content, the video version of this episode. Plus, don't forget to go and watch Trigger Warning right now, this minute, right now. Find Harriet at harrietdyer.com or on Instagram at harrietdyercomedy. You can find out everything I'm up to at stuartgoldsmith.com or indeed at stuartgoldsmithcomedy across most of the platforms.
Instagram's the one we're going with. And if you fancy, if you haven't checked out my Instagram, not only can you see my increasingly haphazard attempts to make latte art, but also in a slightly more meaningful way, there is a clip from the Eliza Schlesinger podcast that's gone up there recently. And we're going to start doing that more and more with little clips of episodes and clips of people in action. So hang on to those things. And I also had a lovely trip to the Bristol Waste Recycling Centre where I did a little kind of, I was going to say it's a bit like a Tom Scott YouTube video. And that is worth mentioning because I recently guested on Tom Scott's brilliant, brilliant online panel show, Lateral. And believe you me, I could guest on that goddamn show every single day of my life. I had an absolute ball of a time with some other guests who weren't comics. They were sort of a mathematician and a, what did she do? She's brilliant. She was a writer, but more specific than that, like a historian, I believe. This is embarrassing now if you get to it. And it turns out the people were a scuba diver and, think of a job, Stuart, firefighter. Anyway, it was a brilliant, brilliant show. So look out for that. That'll be coming soon. And honestly, all of this stuff, I won't turn this into an official postamble because I'm on a roll here, so I'll keep talking. I'm so excited. These episodes that we've got, an in-depth discussion with Leo Reich about sincerity online and the impossibility of being sincere. You know, it's a thing of mine. It comes up all the time on the show when I'm discussing, like, how, as Helen Barra said, how I am cringe because I'm too old to be insincere online. So I say things sincerely and it's the worst thing a person under 30 can imagine. And Leo, just so you know, has released his fucking debut, his debut Edinburgh show, Literally Who Cares, which is a work of staggering quality. He not only transferred it to Broadway, the scamp, but it's coming out, I think, on HBO. So have a search for that. I think you get access to HBO if you've got Sky or Now TV or some sort of an app. But it is, what a show. What a funny show. And also Josh Pugh. And Josh Pugh came to me fresh from recording one of his amazing Instagram, you know, little kind of character piece, micro sketches, little 60-second long things that he's so wonderful at. And I tell you what's great is I keep mentioning Josh Pugh to friends who aren't in comedy to find out that they know exactly who he is and they're all over it. So that's very exciting as well. And the Mawan one is just a dream from start to finish. So lots of stuff coming up soon. Lots of exciting bookings as well. I'm on my way to record with someone very exciting today. And someone absolutely massive in comedy is returning to the pod in January. So there's plenty to look forward to. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. I hope you have a sustainable new year. And on that subject, of course, if you... And I'll just mention this briefly once or twice per few shows, because it does seem to work. If you work in sustainability or the corporate world, I've got so many things to talk to you about and so many mad plans I've been hatching that have all... that are all coming to fruition in a way which probably necessitates a special episode at some point in the future, so I don't keep wanging on about it now. Have a wonderful holiday and try and maintain over Christmas as a consistent sense of self, if you want, but equally just let your hair down.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.